Sir Andrew Hall's reporter, Reel 6. Sir Andrew, you were just talking about...
Homer's G1s. Well, after Mac Maxon, he had a splendid chap, and I simply my old age, I can't remember his name, except that his first name was George. And he was a splendid man. Most efficient, understanding, and helpful. And his AQMG was also a very nice tank corps man, called Jeffrey. It is terrible to get old and remember to forget names, but George and Jeffrey were, couldn't be more helpful to all the cavalry and yeomanry who were forming this Hobo's 11th Armored Division. And Hobo really, he captured us, or he captured our trust and liking, and I think he changed his mind about cavalry. But then the War Office said he was getting too old, and they posted him off to look after what they call funnies, queer things, which he did so very well. And eventually Pip Roberts commanded the 11th Armoured, which was one of the best armoured divisions in the invasion. Unfortunately, by that time, my regiment had been posted away to Italy. That'll do about Herbert.
You mentioned earlier on in the interview that about this time you went for a refresher course to Bovington.
Oh, yeah. It was a long time before. I mean, yeah. I think it's irrelevant, but we went there, I think, just to refresh a course, yeah. Short course.
At that time, did you come across other cavalry outfits who were being mechanised?
No. Oh. No, they weren't at that time.
Sorry.
Before that, yeah.
What was the general attitude to other cavalry people being mechanised? Were they glad of that, or what was their general approach? Was it like yours?
I don't know. I didn't discuss it with them. I think they probably thought it was inevitable. I think everybody realised that it was inevitable. I don't think anyone wanted to go to war on a horse. The only crashing mistake, I reckon, of the whole war was made. I suppose they didn't have enough... who am I to say it's a mistake? I suppose they didn't have enough armour to equip a division. But I always thought it was the most absurd idea, sending a cavalry division to Palestine, which they did in 1940, this about March, April, sort of February, early, before the balloon went up. They took a fine cavalry division to Palestine to patrol about the place there. And then, of course, when the war became very sticky, they were mechanized out there, as you know. No, I think we all realised that the day of the horse was done.
Did the formation of the RAC, the Royal Armoured Corps, affect you?
No.
What was your reaction to that?
No, none at all. None at all. No, I mean, it didn't make any difference in those days. None at all.
You didn't feel any sort of loss of regimental detrition?
No, there's no regiment. I mean, there are whole regiments. As it's gone on, there is rather a more fluid basis of cross-posting and commands. No, it made no difference at all. I think it's a good thing to have this director of Royal Armoured Corps at various places to keep the infantry straight about the use of armour. I think that is a very good idea. DRACs, then they had local ones. They had a DRAC at the War Office, and then they had local DRAC directors, well, sub-directors, as they call them, at various command headquarters. And I think that's where BRAC, they call it, Brigadier's RAC. I think that is a very good idea.
When you went out to France in 1939, rather,
yeah,
the 40 period, you were given a role of sort of reconnaissance and to make speedy contact and fight the enemy.
Yes.
Do you think that was a valid role to be given?
Oh, yes. Yes, I think that was See, the trouble then when we went out there was that, to refresh our memory, the Maginot Line had been at ceased before the Belgian frontier, or before that. And the Belgians were still being frightfully neutral. And we dug, I mean, I'm not going to go into long details about this, but we dug a defensive line in France, facing the Belgian border. And everybody knew that the Germans came through, that it wouldn't be much good. So the strategy was that if the Germans attacked, the British Army would get out of its trenches and move to the River Dyle. And we, the 12th Lancers, under Army command, we were to go further on, up to into Belgium, onto the River Jet, and make contact with Belgians and French, or whoever was there. And that's precisely what did happen. And we went up, we spent the winter in billets by Arras. But sometimes there was a flap, and we used to go up to temporary kick-off places near Lille, which we several times went up there, but always came back. When the idea was we would have a good kick-off from Lille when we went to the Jet. But actually on May the 10th, when it came, we were back in around Arras. So we hopped in the cars and motored straight up to the Jet and took up the positions which we'd worked out all winter on the map. Herbert Lumsden had the whole thing sewn up. Herbert happened to be in Leeds in London. At the time we moved up, we just went up there. And Herbert then, he came up 48 hours later. By that time we'd made contact with the French DLMs, Division Légère Mécanique, and some rather fair Belgians, the 18th Cuirassiers, I think they were. They weren't as bad as some. But then, as you know, the situation deteriorated.
Prior to that, had you done manoeuvres and that with the French?
Oh, yes. Well, so the whole thing was to get to know these the DLMs. Well, they were all mostly ex-cavalrymen. They were all like us. And they were first-class chaps, and we liked them very much, and they had damn good tanks. But they got, the two DLMs got absolutely knocked flat at this place, Tirlemont, where we were, which was coming down, the Germans are coming down from St. Trond. And they suffered terrible casualties. First-class troops. Afterwards, I must say, during our, we did rear guard to the BEF back to, we were doing rear guard back the whole time, rushing about the place. The other French were not very impressive. Not very impressive.
These manoeuvres that you did with the French, you know, in the early 1940s...
Well, we didn't do any manoeuvres. We just went to saw them. Ah. They came over and showed us their motor cars. And we showed them theirs. And they dined with us. I think some of them dined. Well, we had squadron messes, and various regiments dined with squadron messes. Good fellas.
Oh, there weren't any sort of big exercises?
No.
Things like that?
No.
Did you feel, while you were out there, that the training you'd had in Egypt and that was going to come in useful?
Oh, yes. Oh, we continued that troop training, that sort of thing, yeah. Troop training, and one or two. Mind you, you see, it's very difficult to do single exercises because they're supposed to be, even in peacetime, they're supposed to be a while of silence. We did get permission once or twice to do a good single exercise. Otherwise, it was keeping fit. And that fairly well.
What did you think of this idea of having active combat French liaison officers with you?
That was very important. It was very important, really, from the administrative point of view, why were we billeted in France before the phony war? Because the French civilians are always a sour lot, especially in the part of Calais. And they'd had their grandfathers and fathers had seen the war firsthand. We were sitting in all the places which had been battlefields of the First World War. In fact, it was a rather cheerful aspect that we were sitting outside of a cemetery with about 2,000 little crosses, which didn't seem to upset the troops very much. And the people there, they'd had their stomach full of war in 1914-18. They weren't awfully forthcoming, but if you had each squadron of ours had a liaison officer. And my personal chap was a fellow called De Falaise Coudre, the Marquis. And he smoothed down any troubles between the village and the troops and the billets and everything else. And when we were committed to the fighting, he was of tremendous use as an extra liaison officer. He made contact with the French and the Belgians. Yes, it was very important to have a liaison officer to each squadron. One of our French liaison officers was captured very early on, and he was a prisoner of the whole war. He'd taken a wrong turning, going looking for maps with one of our young officers, Tim Bailey. It was the first 5 days of the war, the most extraordinary coincidence. Tim Bailey's father, Percy Bailey, who was a great Croft Lancer, he had been captured just after the Battle of Mons in 1914. So it's rather odd that father and son both should be caught at the beginning of the war. Oh, that's irrelevant.
You mentioned maps there. What was the sort of, you say, the standard of map reading in the 12th Lancers? Had you done a lot of work on that?
Yes, I think it was very good. Yes. Oh, but maps, yes. In point of fact, that was quite an interesting do, was because we'd handed in, when we went up to the jet, we took over at 2 hours. We were always at 2 hours' notice, the whole of the phony war. And we just handed in our local maps of France and took over Belgian maps. And then, of course, 10 days later, we were back round Arras without any bleeding maps. But we got Michelin maps. We worked on Michelin maps. And as far as I know, I left actually in my billet at a place called Fonck Villas. I left all my kit. I had a certain amount of kit that I'd brought out in October and the maps. And of course, I suppose the Boche got that.
Would you say, in your experience, that there was a good sort of liaison between the French and the British and then the Belgian?
No. No, I wouldn't. No, my experience was that we had tremendous liaison with these two DLMs. But the infantry, occasionally we fought. Can't tell you where we fought all over the place. Whenever you met a French battalion, sometimes holding ground, they weren't. They had no stomach for the fight. No. It happened to me several times that we find taking a bit of ground and or get a hold of a bit of ground and we find a battalion there, make plans with the colonel, and a couple of hours later we find they'd vamoosed. No, I wasn't very impressed with them. But I think that their morale was poor, except for these Division Légère Mécanique, and they were all completely written off around St. Trond. But I suppose, after when we left They must have gone on fighting south, but they had all their heavy tanks away to the south around Paris, so we never saw them. But there's no doubt the training which we'd had stood us in very good stead. And the training with the wireless, the great thing was to be in touch with the situation. We were always in touch with the situation, where a lot of other sets, and I think I've forgotten what it was, were the sets that the divisional cavalry, who are in miserable little light tanks and carriers, they were quite useless, and they were always pretty well out of touch. But our number 9 set was first class, you see.
Mm. And the sort of training you'd had beforehand?
Yes, that did good, but the set, too. The set.
Mm. How did you manage about fuel in that, when you were retreating like this?
Oh, it's always easy if you're retreating. Get any amount of fuel. And whiskey, if you want to fall back on the burning nappies. It's only when you're advancing this trouble with supplies. Retreating is easy. Oh, yes.
Yeah. Was the organization and discipline well in hand when you...
Yes, with the regiment, yes. And I think it was pretty good right through the army. We did summer down, yes. Now, I'd say the discipline is very good, really. And even down on the beaches of La Panne, we had to go to La Panne. And we had to protect them for a bit, because there weren't any embarkation staff officers. They'd got lost somehow. I think they'd got on board the destroyers and couldn't find their way back or something. So we had to take over control of the beaches, the 12 Lancers. And the chaps were jolly good. There were a lot of troops there without officers and pretty... But the discipline is all right. The only bit of ill discipline I ever saw was some Belgian staff officers. And I was up to my neck in water trying to get these boats off to the destroyers. And a group of very excited Belgian staff officers came down. And with them was a friend of mine who was a policeman, a military policeman, called Ken Alexander. And Ken said, I think these fellows, they're very important to get these fellows from England. And I said, well, they'd have to wait. You've got some wounded. And it was a bit difficult to get the boats off, because you had to... it was a shelving beach at La Panne, and you had to wait for the waves, then get into the boat and shove it off. And I explained to these fellows, when eventually we did give them a boat, that you have to get in each side. And they all I broken French and gesticulation. They all sort of nodded their heads. And I said, right, you know, one lot this side, one lot that side, then get in. And all the buggers, they ran at the thing on one side and overturned the capsized it. And it's the only time I ever used my revolver in the war. I pulled out my revolver and I fired into the water and over their heads and everything else. And turned the bugger off. And Ken was laughing. You see, he took them off. I don't know what happened to them after that. Oh God, I was cross with them. But we ran out of sort of we got a few old lorries and made a bit of a pier. We got them off. But it was pretty disheartening, because after about 24 hours there, they started to shell. And the destroyers went away from the pants. So we were left with about 20,000 troops and no boats, so they had to shuffle off down further south.
By that time, you'd left your cars and things, had
you?
Oh,
yes, we destroyed them, put them in the canal.
Yeah. You took no equipment whatsoever?
Just really rifles, well, yeah. Took no equipment at all. And I'm not. Except my liaison officer, Sir Henry Falaise's suitcase. I jettisoned that and found afterwards that it was full of very important personal papers, which upset him very much. And, however, I think he came out of it all right. I don't think I'll say any more about that.
Thank you, Senator. That's fine.